Yeah, that's an all-time favorite of mine. Sonny Stitt opening up on Blues Greasy with sidemen Bobby Timmons on piano, Edgar Willis on bass guitar, and Kenny Dennis on drums. It's from Stitt's 1957 album, Personal Appearance. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, July the 3rd, 2015, and we are in for some history lessons today on the eve of the 4th of July. It is appropriate to wrap up this series of discussions we've been having on systems of white supremacy and their centrality to practically all aspects of life in the United States. And this is a very appropriate time to remind us that the job that we have to do is to get a fix on where we are, the reality that we're living in, and there is a good amount of history to provide us some kind of pointers as to where we are. We will hear first from Dr. Gerald Horn, the John J. and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies and Professor of Diplomatic History at the University of Houston. He's the author of The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. I actually should let you know that this is a repeat of a program that I did with him last year on June the 6th, but it is so relevant, it is so incredibly important that I thought I would revive it and bring to your attention the essential theme here. And that is this creation myth of how this country was formed and the great founding fathers and so forth and so on. The story that has basically served as the reality of the nation. And much of what it is I've been talking about is this bifurcation, this schizophrenic life that this country has had. When the reality that a vast number of people know is literally buried. It is dismissed as being unimportant. And yet it is vital, especially for those who, like me, identify as being a member of an oppressed class in this country. America's War of Independence, as Gerald Horn reminds us, was actually a counter-revolution by the white power elite. And they waged this counter-revolution because it was abundantly clear that Britain was about, had no choice, I should put it. It was inevitable that Britain would abolish slavery. And they were all the more concerned about wresting power from Britain, because throughout the Caribbean and throughout the black world, there was ample evidence of rebellions, most specifically in Haiti, that clearly indicated that rebellion was spreading beyond the Caribbean. The British were forced, essentially, to abolish slavery because of these rebellions. And the power elite in the United States anticipated that that was inevitable in the United States and the colonies, as it were. So they basically took a preemptive strike. And it was, of course, to maintain slavery. And it's not about this business about taxation without representation and all those other things that we're told, these noble ideals that were pursued. Essentially, they saw their survival as being absolutely tied, inextricably tied, bound up with slavery. So let's hear from Gerald Horn. It's a pretty sizable clip, but it is instruction only to remind us about the reality that people say we have and the reality that we know we had and continue to have. Dr. Gerald Horn talking with me on June the 4th, 2014. Because of this resistance, this strong resistance that began, the rebellions, the successful rebellions in the Caribbean that began to teach them a lesson, it was likely that if the new elites of America were to continue resisting the domination of the British, it was quite possible that the African slaves would forge an alliance with the British and help them subdue the rebellious colonists. So as a preventive measure, the revolution was waged, and it therefore was not a revolution, but a counter-revolution. That's the name, the title of the book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, written by our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn. Those of you listening to this program know that Dr. Horn has been with us so many times, helping us understand world events from an entirely different perspective. He holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He is a prolific author, having written more than 30 books and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. And this most recent book, again the title, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, is the most recent, published on April the 18th this year. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us again today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, you haven't been wasting very much time, I see. This book is not even a year from your last book, which is related, it seems, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation, that came out just last year, July. So it seems that you've been dealing with this question about the relationship between slavery and the so-called newfound freedoms of the United States by the founding fathers. But this creation myth, what was the basis of your claim that the revolution of 1776 actually was a counter-revolution?
Well, first of all, parenthesis, within days I'll have a new book coming out, Race to Revolution, United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and it could be considered in the same context. But in any event, with regard to your question, the creation myth, as most who reside in North America know, is that the so-called Olympian founding fathers, capital O, capital F, capital F, the likes of which humanity has never seen before or since, revolted against tyranny in London and successfully revolted and established a wondrous republic with a vaunted constitution, and those who were the alleged beneficiaries of their bounty lived happily ever after, evermore. I tell a different story in this book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. The simplified version is that in June 1772, you had Somerset's case in London, which seemed to suggest that abolition of slavery, which was what the Somerset's case was all about, but was applicable to England, would somehow come to North America. This would at once jeopardize millions of dollars in enslaved property, that is to say property in enslaved Africans. And rather than see that property be evaporated, which is basically what happened in 1865, the colonists revolted, and in many ways were not unlike those who revolted in 1965 against British rule in what was then called Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. They revolted in order to forestall Britain's attempt at decolonization. In 1776, I argued that the colonists revolted in order to forestall what they thought was going to become Britain's attempt at abolition of slavery.
Now, how is it that we had this closed society, a very small group, relatively speaking, of people who wielded so much power, not only politically, but the power to influence this kind of thinking, the thinking of breaking from the British Empire?
Could you refine that question a bit?
Well, I'm trying to get a sense of, they have a vested interest in slavery, but do they make this very clear to everyone, or is this something that is kept close to the vest? And therefore, adopt an entirely different narrative to inspire people to support the break from Britain, but on different grounds.
Well, I think it's a mixture of responses. One, if you look at their writings, it was clear that slavery was a trigger for their revolt. But like any public relations enterprise, they felt that the better part of wisdom, particularly in gathering international support, would be to somehow cloak their actual meaning. I should also say that you can't understand the origins of the United States of America without understanding its constant companion, and that is the construction of whiteness. Listeners need to ask themselves, how is it that those who were English and Irish and Scot and Welsh on one side of the Atlantic somehow magically become white once they cross the Atlantic to North America? Like some scholars who have come before me, I suggest that this was a kind of identity politics, and it's very curious that the term identity politics is quite frequently used today in 2014, but it's rarely applied not only to the original identity politics, which was the politics of whiteness, but the identity politics of the 18th century, and to a degree the late 17th century, was a militarized identity politics. In other words, this was a kind of identity politics that facilitated the crushing of those who were not defined as, quote, white, unquote, the indigenous, for example, and the Africans, for example. And many of the non-affluent amongst those defined as white thought that it would be in their material interest to participate in this revolt because, A, they could then benefit from the seizing of expropriated land from the indigenous population, and that this land could then be stocked by Africans who would be forced to work for free. And secondly, I think that in this book, I try to shed some light on what some called simple democracy, what others call bourgeois democracy, what others call civil liberties. That is to say that in order to attract Europeans to a war zone, which was what North America was in the 18th century, that there had to be inducements, there had to be enticements. Now, part of those inducements and enticements I've already sketched, that is to say land seized from the indigenous worked by Africans. But part of the inducement as well was a package of so-called civil liberties. That is to say that before 1776 and indeed thereafter to a degree, there was something of a religious Cold War, that is to say Catholic powers, Spain and France on the one hand, jousting with the Protestant power that was England and then Britain on the other. What was the alleged genius of the founders of the United States was their ability to at least call a formal truce with regard to the religious Cold War and shift the discourse from whether or not you were Catholic or Protestant to whether or not you were white. Mm-hmm. Now, in a nutshell, that's the alleged genius of the United States of America.
In the meantime, the parallel a parallel history is unfolding in the Caribbean with respect to a direct challenge by slaves to these world, by then, world powers. How did this parallel track come to intersect with respect to the counter-revolution of 1776?
Well, with all due respect to previous scholars, and I have to tread carefully here because someone will be reviewing this book, I think part of the failure of a lot of scholarship in terms of analyzing 1776 was they analyze it as pre-United States history. In other words, they only look at the history of the 13 colonies. They don't look at the history of Jamaica, Antigua, Barbados, for example, even though these are all part of the British Empire. They're all administered from London, and there is a close connection between and amongst the Caribbean islands and the tree that eventually becomes the United States of America. In a nutshell, what I suggest is that you can't understand 1776 without understanding 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution in England, which causes the monarchy to take a step back and the rising merchant class to take a step forward. This also holds true with regard to the Royal African Company, which theretofore had a virtual monopoly with regard to the African slave trade. With the Glorious Revolution, you basically had a deregulation of the African slave trade, allowing merchants to enter en masse into this lucrative commerce. They descend upon Africa like maniacally crazed bees, manacling and handcuffing every African in sight and driving them across the Atlantic, particularly to the Caribbean. And up until the mid-18th century, London felt that the Caribbean was more valuable than the mainland. The problem with dragging so many Africans to the Caribbean was that they were quickly outnumbering the Europeans and quickly seizing, or at least trying to seize power and trying to take over. Evidence, Antigua, 1709, one of many liquidation plots by enslaved Africans in the Caribbean islands. This causes many of the European settlers to then migrate to the North American mainland, but that does not allow them to escape the wrath of enslaved Africans who, of course, engage in major slave revolts on the mainland in 1712 in New York, 1739 in South Carolina, perhaps the bloodiest slave revolt in British colonial history, 1741 New York City, etc. At the same time, you find that the British, under competitive pressure from the Spanish, who had begun arming Africans under their different model of development as early as the 1500s, were shellacking Britain throughout the hemisphere, not least in Cartagena, what is now Colombia, circa 1740, 1741. This is putting pressure on Britain to arm Africans as well, which is alarming and outraging and enraging the settlers in the so-called 13 colonies who had embarked on a model of development that presupposed tyrannical despotism against people of African descent, not putting arms in their hands. This is one of the irritants that causes a rupture between the colonies and London by 1776.
Now, that narrative that you just laid out there, I mean, it is so radically different. It is such an extraordinary analysis because, in a way, it says not only that we have a different reason for the development of the rationale for breaking from the British Empire, but we have an instant analysis of how Britain itself construed its colonies in the Caribbean and its colonies in the United States and the role of this concept of whiteness identity that differentiated, that further differentiated, at least in the minds of the founding fathers, well, we're not like them. We are quasi-autonomous. We are in charge. We have intelligence. We can govern ourselves. We are not a colony in the sense that Antigua is a colony or Jamaica is a colony or Trinidad is a colony.
Well, a couple points here. One, I think, as I argue in the book, that in order to understand what happened in 1776, it's also useful to look in the hemisphere. One of the many points that causes us to reflect on the differences between slavery in the Americas generally and slavery in what became the United States is this, that in Cuba, for example, there was a confluence between the struggle against slavery and the struggle against colonialism in the figure of Antonio Maceo, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, there was a confluence between the struggle against slavery and the struggle against Spanish colonialism. You know that Vicente Guerrero, a man of African descent, was president of Mexico 180 years before Barack Obama ascended to the White House. In the United States, the struggle against slavery and the struggle against colonialism arguably were at loggerheads. That is also reflected in the fact that by a significant degree, the Africans in North America did not side with the rebels, contrary to what you might have been taught in school, but sided with the British because the British, as they saw it, had the cleanest, dirty shirt. And I think we need to step back for a second and recognize that when you begin to make this sort of argument,
forgive me for laughing, but I didn't expect that expression, the cleanest, dirty shirt.
Well, you know, some of our friends, but even those on the left, they also left this position when you begin to make this argument. They, you know, they start to condemn Britain. But the question is relative. I'm not saying that Britain was a paragon of humanity. I'm saying, and the Africans were saying, that from the point of view of their best interest in 1776, it was represented more effectively by London than by these rebellious colonists, just like the Africans in Rhodesia in 1965 did not side with the rebels under Ian Smith, even though they recognized that London at 1965 was no paragon of virtue. I think that you can't understand the subsequent history of the United States of America without understanding what I'm saying. Right now, the history of the United States, even as espoused by many on the left, doesn't make any sense. In other words, you had this grand, glorious revolution of 1776, but then the rebels went on to captain the slave trade, bringing more Africans to Cuba than those who had come before them, bringing more Africans to Brazil than those who had come before them. That's, of course, represented in my book, The Deepest South, the United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade. And the bad guys, London, then becomes the leader of the abolitionist movement, and the Royal Navy begins to, as the cop on the beat, trying to detain slave ships carrying the Stars and Stripes from going into Africa, not least because after losing America, the major market for London's slaving was basically wiped out. It was taken over by these rebels who then used that market to leverage into other markets, such as Cuba and Brazil, for example. And Britain had little choice but to move into abolition since their major market had been taken away from them. I think we have a long row to hoe with regard to the rewriting of U.S. history. The good news is that that'll keep younger scholars in business for decades to come.
I want to touch on another element in the Caribbean that had profound impact in the United States, and that is Haiti. Now, yes. We talked about the role of the French and the Spanish in the Caribbean, and in the situation of Saint-Domingue or Hispaniola, we have both the French and the Spanish involved, and we also had a splendid example of a successful rebellion or series of successful rebellions in Haiti that shaped both the view of the slave and the slaves' own view of themselves and their ability to pass on their knowledge about military strategy and so forth to other communities wanting to free themselves of the yoke of oppression. How did Haiti and the experience of Haiti influence this burgeoning quest for freedom by the so-called founding fathers, even though, of course, they meant the freedom for themselves to subjugate and oppress others?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because beginning in August, I'm going to begin to write a book about Haiti, which will put all of this into context. Suffice it to say for now that even before 1776, the settlers in North America were collaborating with the French and the Spanish and Hispaniola, even though supposedly they were loyal British subjects. And then after they revolted against British rule in 1776, the French and the Spanish collaborated with them against their mutual antagonist, which was London. There's no doubt that this revolt against British rule would not have been successful but for the assistance of the French in particular. That's even established amongst mainstream scholars. Then, after the triumph of the revolt against British rule, what happens is that, as was their wont, these rebellious settlers of North America then beginning dragging more Africans in Hispaniola, which contributes to a demographic imbalance. That is to say, the Africans wildly outnumber the Europeans, which creates fertile soil for the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804. You suggested in your question quite correctly that, like many revolutionaries before or since, the Haitian revolutionaries were interested in spreading the gospel of abolitionism and anti-slavery throughout the hemisphere. This terrified the settlers in North America. And indeed, if you look very closely and carefully, and I think this will be one of the contributions of the book on Haiti, if you look closely and carefully at the subsequent slave revolts that take place in North America, not least Gabriel's revolt circa 1800 in Virginia, or Denmark Vesey's circa 1820, 1821 in South Carolina, or even Nat Turner's revolt circa 1831 in Virginia, they have Haitian fingerprints all over them. This leads to something else, which is in 1844, you see the United States assisting the opponents of the Haitians in the eastern part of the island in seceding from Haiti and establishing what is called the Dominican Republic. There's evidence to suggest that John C. Calhoun, one of South Carolina's leading patriots, a noted white supremacist, was heavily involved in the events that led to the secession of the Dominican Republic, making the DR one of the few countries that can say that its independence was born and birthed in a revolt against a predominantly black country, which made light on subsequent events such as, I'm sure you've seen the pictures of Sammy Sosa, the Dominican baseball player, and his attempt to eradicate the melanin from his skin. I mean, you know, that doesn't come from the blue. That comes from a particular set of historical circumstances.
So coming back to the Founding Fathers, did you find in putting the book together and doing your research, did you find any overt evidence of their concern that their fortunes tied as they were inextricably to slavery, and therefore their interest was in protecting slavery and propagating slavery? Did you find evidence of a, for lack of a better term, a kind of cover-up of their true intentions?
Well, the short answer is yes. I mean, first of all, I wouldn't call it a cover-up. I mean, slavery was widely accepted in the 18th century. That's one of the reasons why in 1861, when the so-called Confederate States of America tried to secede and establish a new country, basically on the principle of enslavement of Africans, they were very explicit that this was their intention, even though their descendants nowadays try to act like it was all a struggle about states' rights. And Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, the leaders of the Confederacy felt with some justification that they were walking in the footsteps of the founders of the Republic in 1776. You should also know that in addition to slavery, there's this complement, which is taking the land from the Native Americans. And there's little doubt, this was explicit, that the settlers were very upset with London because London was trying to set boundaries with regard to how far west these settlers could go in seizing the land of the Native Americans, because it always involved war, it involved conflict, it involved expenditures for the exchequer in London, and London had a sprawling empire in India, not least, and all of these repetitive conflicts in North America was seen as inimical to London's interests, but the settlers saw things differently, because as they saw it, it would be quite profitable, and it was quite profitable, to take the land of the Native Americans and then bring more Africans across the Atlantic to work the land.
Mm-hmm. Well, how, therefore, did we get to the point of not understanding that to be the primary motivation for this so-called war of independence, but that we get to understand the War of Independence being about freedom, democracy, and equality for all these high-minded ideals, but we never got to understand that what was really behind it was the interest of this power elite to protect their heavy vested interest in maintaining slavery.
Well, that opens up a new book project for a younger scholar to figure out how all of these historians got it wrong. Let me enter the realm of speculation. I suspect that it is true that the United States did help to rescue a countless number of Europeans, and that many of the historians who happen to be of European descent, because, of course, Africans were generally barred from the profession until quite recently in a historical sense, and they were so blinded by the fact that their ancestors were rescued, that it made them think that perhaps this was a positive leap forward for humanity, the fact that Britain was ousted and the so-called Republicans took over. Because keep in mind that the principle of anti-monarchy is an important principle. You know, it's rather curious that you have Britain, which has a head of state based upon what family you're born into, has the temerity to talk about term limits and with regard to African countries. When if you're not born into the right family, you can't qualify to be king or queen. And so that principle was very important, and I think that helped to blind some of the previous historians. But what's curious is that in the United States, as you well know, you have critics of every revolution that's taken place since 1776, the French Revolution, Russian Revolution, Cuban Revolution, Iranian Revolution. And they're critiquing these revolutions, some with regard to the French Revolution, they do pluses and minuses. Others with regard to the revolution in Russia, there's no pluses and minuses, all minuses. But what's curious with regard to what happened here, you have all these black people walking across land in North America, and you would think that this would make people think, well, how did they get here? Were they beneficiaries of 1776, et cetera? But you get the idea that it was all upside with regard to 1776, no downside. This is even with regard to so-called progressive historians. At best, you'll hear them say, well, the revolution in 1776 was an incomplete revolution. Well, that's like saying apartheid was an incomplete revolution. You know, the fact that you could benefit Europeans fleeing from Lithuania created a template for the African majority, which, of course, is ludicrous, is turning Nelson Mandela's jailer into its liberator, which is the kind of eschewed history repetitively since 1776.
Well, having written this book, what would you say is the greatest, for you as a historian, the most significant discovery in writing this book?
Well, first of all, I think the previous historians have really downplayed the restiveness of the Africans on the North American mainland. They'll talk about the restiveness of the Africans in the Caribbean. They have to. I mean, come on. You had the Jamaican Maroons, who as early as the 1730s had Britain on the ropes. It was a fear that the whole colonial project would collapse. I mean, that's well recognized. But regard to the Africans on the mainland, you get the idea that they were just twiddling their thumbs or just going along with the program. The other aspect that I would stress here is that the concept of racism, which I use quite a bit and others use quite a bit, is necessary but insufficient to explicate what has befallen people of African descent in North America, even to this very day. Department of Education report saying just recently that black preschoolers, black male preschoolers, 3- and 4-year-olds, are suspended at a spectacularly higher rate than other preschoolers. A letter written to the New York Times suggested that eventually we'll move to a point black infants are segregated because they'll be seen as crying louder than other kinds of infants. He was joking, but, you know, United States, you never can be too sure. The spectacularly high imprisonment rates, disproportionately cited on death row, for example. Yes, racism is useful in understanding that, but what I try to suggest is that the Africans basically are reaping the misfortune of fighting unsuccessfully against the formation of a slaveholders' republic in 1776, then fighting against a Jim Crow regime that follows that slaveholders' republic after the U.S. Civil War, and are now reaping the structural inequalities that flow from those indecisive victories that we have been able to attain. I also suggest that there has been a peculiar persecution of descendants of mainland enslaved Africans. That is to say that Angela Davis, for example, talks at some length about growing up at Jim Crow Birmingham, how in order to escape the strictures of Jim Crow, she would speak French, and then they wouldn't think she was descendant of a mainland enslaved African. Raymond Pace Alexander, the celebrated Black Philadelphia lawyer, does the same thing, speaking foreign languages. The question of passing, that is to say, lighter-skinned Negroes somehow passing as white, passing needs to be broadened as a concept. That is to say, there was this understandable effort by descendants of enslaved mainland Africans to try to adopt a new identity to escape the hell and the atrocities that were visited upon them because of the perception that they were in the vanguard of fighting against the formation of the United States of America. And like any group that fights and loses a war, they and their descendants will be subjected to persecution forevermore unless and until they are able to organize, not least in the international community, to overturn that sorry state of affairs.
Dr. Gerald Horn, talking with me just last year on June the 4th, about his book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. Much to think about based on what he has offered us today. You might have heard him reference John Calhoun, John C. Calhoun, the white supremacist. I talked about John Calhoun last week when the president delivered his eulogy. The statue of John Calhoun loomed over him and everyone else. At the funeral of the late state senator Clementa Pinckney, who was buried last week. And now, in order to reinforce this idea of just literally assessing where we are, if we are to move forward at all, here are the prescient words of Frederick Douglass, words that still ring true.
Citizens, I am not wanting in respect for the fathers of this republic. The signers of the Declaration of Independence were brave men. They were great men, too, great enough to give frame to a great age. It does not often happen to a nation to raise at one time such a number of truly great men. The point from which I am compelled to view them is not certainly the most favorable. And yet, I cannot contemplate their great deeds with less than admiration. They were statesmen, patriots, and heroes, and for the good they did and the principles they contended for, I will unite with you to honor their memory. They loved their country better than their own private interests, and though this is not the highest form of human excellence, all will concede that it is a rare virtue, and that when it is exhibited, it ought to command respect. He who will intelligently lay down his life for his country is a man whom it is not in human nature to despise. Your fathers staked their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor on the cause of their country. In their admiration of liberty, they lost sight of all other interest. They were peace men. But they preferred revolution to peaceful submission to bondage. They were quiet men, but they did not shrink from agitating against oppression. They showed forbearance, but they knew its limits. They believed in order, but not in the order of tyranny. With them, nothing was settled that was not right. With them, justice, liberty, and humanity were final, not slavery and oppression. You may well cherish the memory of such men. They were great in their day and generation. Their solid manhood stands out the more as we contrast it with these degenerate times. How circumspect, exact, and proportionate were all their movements. How unlike the politicians of an hour. Their statesmanship looked beyond the passing moment and stretched away in strength into the distant future. They seized upon eternal principles and set a glorious example in their defense. Mark them. Fully appreciating the hardships to be encountered, firmly believing in the right of their cause, honorably inviting the scrutiny of an onlooking world, reverently appealing to heaven to attest their sincerity, soundly comprehending the solemn responsibility they were about to assume, wisely measuring the terrible odds against them, your fathers, the fathers of this republic, did most deliberately, under the inspiration of a glorious patriotism and with a sublime faith in the great principles of justice and freedom, lay deep the cornerstone of the national superstructure, which has risen and still rises in grandeur around you. Of this fundamental work, this day is the anniversary. Our eyes are met with demonstrations of joyous enthusiasm. Banners and pennants wave exultingly on the breeze. The din of business, too, is hushed. Even Mammon seems to have quitted his grasp on this day. The ear-piercing fife and the stirring drum unite their accents with the ascending peal of 1,000 church bells. Prayers are made, hymns are sung, and sermons are preached in honor of this day. While the quick martial tramp of a great and multitudinous nation, echoed back by all the hills, valleys, and mountains of a vast continent, bespeak the occasion one of thrilling and universal interest, a nation's jubilee. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of national justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs? I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak, and the lame man leap as an hart. But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you, this day, rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? If so, there is a parallel to your conduct. And let me warn you that it is dangerous to copy the examples of a nation whose crimes, towering up to heaven, were thrown down by the breath of the Almighty, burying that nation in irrevocable ruin. I can today take up the plaintive lament of a peeled and woe-smitten people. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there, they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondman, making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on the 4th of July. Whether returned to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command. And yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice, or who is not at heart a slaveholder, shall not confess to be right and just. But I fancy I hear someone of my audience say, it is just in this circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists fail to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there is nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. The slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of laws of their government. They acknowledge it when they punish disobedience on the part of the slave. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, no matter how ignorant he be, subject him to the punishment of death, while only two of the same crimes will subject a white man to the like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? The manhood of the slave is conceded. It is admitted in the fact that Southern statute books are covered with enactments forbidding, under severe fines and penalties, the teaching of the slave to read or to write. When you can point to any such laws in reference to the beasts of the field, then I may consent to argue the manhood of the slave. When the dogs in your street, when the fowls of the air, when the cattle on your hills, when the fish of the sea and the reptiles that crawl shall be unable to distinguish the slave from a brute, then will I argue with you that the slave is a man. For the present, it is enough to affirm the equal manhood of the Negro race. Is it not astonishing that while we are plowing, planting, and reaping, using all kinds of mechanical tools, erecting houses, constructing bridges, building ships, working in metals of brass, iron, copper, silver, and gold, that while we are reading, writing, and ciphering, acting as clerks, merchants, and secretaries, having among us lawyers, doctors, ministers, poets, authors, editors, orators, and teachers, that while we are engaged in all manner of enterprises common to other men, digging gold in California, capturing the whale in the Pacific, feeding sheep and cattle on the hillside, living, moving, acting, thinking, planning, living in families as husbands, wives, and children, and above all, confessing and worshiping the Christian's God, and looking hopefully for life and immortality beyond the grave, we are called upon to prove that we are men. Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty, that he is the rightful owner of his own body? You have already declared it. Must I argue the wrongfulness of slavery? Is that a question for Republicans? Is it to be settled by the rules of logic and argumentation as a matter beset with great difficulty, involving a doubtful application of the principle of justice, hard to be understood? How should I look today in the presence of Americans, dividing and subdividing a discourse to show that men have a natural right to freedom, speaking of it relatively and positively, negatively and affirmatively? To do so would be to make myself ridiculous and to offer an insult to your understanding. There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What? Am I to argue that it is wrong to make men brutes, to rob them of their liberty, to work them without wages, to keep them ignorant of their relations to their fellow men, to beat them with sticks, to flay their flesh with the lash, to load their limbs with irons, to hunt them with dogs, to sell them at auction, to sunder their families, to knock out their teeth, to burn their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters? Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. I have better employment for my time and strength than such arguments would imply. What then remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine? That God did not establish it? That our doctors of divinity are mistaken? There is blasphemy in the thought. That which is inhuman cannot be divine. Who can reason on such a proposition? They that can may. I cannot. The time for such argument is past. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed.
Oh, had I the ability. The legendary actor Ossie Davis reading from the text of Frederick Douglass's very famous speech in 1852, What to the Slave is the 4th of July? That speech was made in Rochester, New York, before the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society. I hope these two interviews, and the interview and the speech by Frederick Douglass, gives us yet another reason to reassess where we are. Thank you so much for listening, and I really, really would like to hear from you at leadstories@gmail.com. The Lifeboat Hour with Carolyn Baker is up next. You want to stay tuned for that, and we'll see each other on the radio, of course, on Monday. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.